Hello, this is Dr. David Friedman, host of To Your Good Health Radio. Today we are exploring the depths of depression, a multifaceted illness that can shave years off of a person's life. Joining us is Dr. Philip Gold, one of the world's leading researchers on depressive illness. He'll share the eye-opening data on how depression is a total body disease that's silently linked to major health risks like heart disease, diabetes, and osteoporosis. We'll explore the stress connection and strategies that can help you regain control. And Dr. Gold will cover all the latest in genetic frontiers where gene therapy is emerging as the beacon of hope, potentially reversing the very mutations that sap our mental resilience. This is not just another conversation. It's a journey to the core of healing. Don't go anywhere. It all starts now.
It's To Your Good Health Radio with number one best-selling author and renowned wellness expert, Dr. David Friedman, changing lives just for the health of it.
Joining us next is a world-renowned authority on depressive illness with over three decades of research at the National Institutes of Health. As a pioneer in the neuroendocrinology of depression, he significantly advanced our insights into the brain-based roots of the condition. His contributions to the field include leading a team at NIH, authoring over 400 scientific articles, and receiving numerous accolades, such as the American Psychiatric Association's highest honor. He's a recognized, distinguished, influential speaker across prestigious institutes worldwide, and his expertise is not only shaping the future of psychiatric research, but also offering new hope for millions battling with depression. Welcome to the show, author of Breaking Through Depression, A Guide to the Next Generation of Promising Research and Revolutionary New Treatments, Dr. Philip Gold.
Hello, thank you for that nice introduction.
Oh, so great to have you on the show. And, you know, trying to shorten your extremely long bio and list of accolades caused a little stress, but thankfully it did not lead to depression. So you would have to treat me. So I'm okay there. But boy, that was a task. Share with us first the backstory about what inspired your passion about this topic.
Well, I was an English major in college, and I actually had thought about becoming an English professor. But my brother was a physician, and I admired him greatly, and I thought that medicine was an extraordinary way to see life up close, to help people, to save lives. And I saw psychiatry as kind of applied literature, where what you knew about the world and people's behaviors and motivations and feelings could be utilized task of helping people who were depressed or otherwise suffering recover. So I chose psychiatry, and I decided that I would treat depression, since I see depression as sort of an existential crisis, I called it a cancer of the self, where one's self-esteem is profoundly diminished and often associated with feelings of worthlessness.
Wow. What are some strategies? I'm curious, what can we do to promote our own well-being and mental wellness?
You know, I think I will talk later on a little bit about how depression represents a stress system that runs awry. So the burden of internal conflict, stressors that get printed on the brain, and of the way one ordinarily feels about oneself and one's life plays a great role in making individuals susceptible to depression. For many people who are under that kind of stress, psychotherapy is very helpful. Otherwise, I think people need to attempt to be reflective and examine what they feel are the major stressors in their life, to try to address them as much as possible, to talk about their lives to the people who they love and who love them, and to get the help of friends and family in getting through an exceedingly stressful situation.
So would you put chronic stress as playing the key role to depression? Is it on top of the list?
Yes. Chronic severe stress is on top of the list. I see depression really as a stress system, as I mentioned, that runs awry. There's a tremendous correspondence between the symptoms of the two major forms of depression that I'll describe and what the actual stress response is like for people who are under stress. First, let me describe the stress response to you by an example of individuals who are out in the woods hiking And they discover that there's a forest fire not far from them. They become very stressed. You know, the principal behavioral manifestation of the stress is anxiety, increased vigilance, focus only on the danger at hand, turning off complex programs of thinking that involve sequences and complex ideas. Then there are other things that go on. Blood pressure goes up, pulse rate goes up, the heart's contractility increases and its strength increases. There is a secretion of stress hormones, predominantly cortisol, and also norepinephrine from the sympathetic nervous system. There are changes in brain areas of the stress system that modulate self-assessment and self-esteem. Self-esteem is not damaged during a stress response, but there is a sense of worry about one's capacity to escape the danger and a resolve to do as much as one can to escape it. There are other things that go on that we don't ordinarily associate with depression, or rather with the stress response. When people are stressed, they become inflamed. The brain becomes inflamed, and there is inflammatory responses throughout the body. And this probably reflects the fact that in our ancient history, when the major stresses were starvation or physical struggle with an adversary or seeking out a mate, these were such major stressors that our ancestors experienced a preliminary or premonitory stress response that didn't become full-blown, but the following things happened. They increased their inflammatory response to protect against a possible injury that might occur during a fight-or-flight situation, and they increased their clotting so that they would be prepared for a potential hemorrhage, so that when we are stressed, even by giving public speech, for instance, it doesn't have to be a physical danger, we become inflamed and our coagulation system is activated. And as you can imagine, that during chronic stress, these changes in blood pressure, heart rate, coagulation, inflammation, and other physical changes can cause the premature onset of severe illnesses. Depressed patients who experience depression over a prolonged period of time, usually in discrete episodes, have an increased risk of premature coronary artery disease, stroke, diabetes, and osteoporosis. And they lose 7 to 10 years of lifespan. So it's critical to treat depression, not only because of the terrible suffering that it causes, the loss of self-esteem, the feelings of worthlessness, the hopelessness, the anticipation that life will not be gratifying and they will not find satisfaction in love and work. There is, in addition, these physical changes that threaten the health of the individual, so that diagnosing and treating depression becomes an imperative. And there are far too few psychiatrists or therapists or people who go seeking help for depressive symptoms that make this a tremendous problem worldwide. The World Health Organization estimates that depression is the second greatest cause of disability worldwide and the greatest cause of disability in people under 45. Because depression can start during childhood, often during adolescence or early adulthood. And by the time people are 45 and they have recurrent depressions, they already are at risk for psychological and physical manifestations that can produce disability.
Let's dive into the stress again, because it really is relative. A 10-level stressful situation for some might be a minuscule 2 to me. How can people put stress into perspective and not let it fester and wreak havoc on the mind and the body?
It's a tall order. I think if it is helpful, if one tries to analyze the stress, and it's hard to do on your own, it's helpful to do it with a therapist, but one can do it on his or her own, to try to identify what the stress is, and to determine whether the quality of the stress or the meaning of the stress to the individual reflects something that they experienced when they were growing up. If they fear losing someone they love or losing a close friend or losing their job, It may be that when they were younger, they felt vulnerable to abandonment, and those early fears return as emotional memories and are very powerful and can provide the content for much of the stress and the experience when stress evolves into a depression. So trying to determine the relationship to the past and to distinguish the past from the present is of major importance. One should identify individual conflicts that one has with friends or family to try to talk these through. That can make an enormous difference in someone who is stressed by their interpersonal relationships.
Yeah. Let me ask you, I know Hippocrates always said all disease begins in the gut, a notion now echoed by contemporary studies linking the microbiome to mental health conditions. This includes depression, perhaps even Alzheimer's disease. I'm curious, how do you perceive that connection between gut health and depression now that it's coming to the forefront?
Right. The gut is very closely connected to the brain and to an area of the brain that runs the stress system. The microbiome, when it's dysregulated, signals from the gut that produce difficult problems and that activate the stress system flow freely. And it's another way of activating the stress system, just like an interpersonal stress or a loss or failure might activate the stress system. So there is a wire called the vagus nerve that runs right up to the brainstem and to the areas close to the brainstem that are involved in running the stress response that evolves into depression if the stress is severe enough and frequent enough and long-lasting enough.
You know, in your book, you share some new science on gene therapy. I want to make sure we get to that. It's talking about a treatment overcoming the gene mutation that interferes with resiliency. Tell us a little bit more in kind of in layman's terms so the audience can understand. Yeah.
The susceptibility to stress is genetic, and depression has many genetic roots. And so if there's a strong family history of depression in first-degree relatives, or if people are prone to stress and to have a very active stress response, this is because of an underlying genetic abnormalities. And some of the genetic abnormalities that have been found in the capacity to be resilient, which is very important in resisting stress, and in the stress response and depression itself, are genes that are involved in running the stress response. Especially, there's one hormone in the brain that produces anxiety, cautious avoidance, fear-related behaviors, increased stress hormone secretion, increased clotting, increased inflammation. And this hormone is elevated in depression, and the gene for this hormone is dysregulated and abnormal. We don't have the technical means to alter genetic structure very much. There have been attempts at curing congenital hearing deficits by injecting genetic material into an accessible area of the ear, and sickle cell disease, which is a blood disease of red blood cells. There have been some successful efforts at treating that disease with gene therapy. But things like treating depression with gene therapy would be very difficult. First of all, there are many different genes that are involved in depression. It's called what we call many gene abnormality. As many as 100 genes are abnormal. Some are more important than others. And it will take the ability to identify these genes, sequence them, find the abnormality in their structure, and change it. There is a method for doing this. It's called, the technical name is CRISPR, which allows you to remove an abnormal component of a gene and replace it with a normal component, which won the discoverer of this technique the Nobel Prize 2 years after it was published. And that gives us a revolutionary capacity to ultimately change the structure of genes when we find abnormalities in them that are related to depression. And so that ultimately will be, I think, the way to cure depression.
Right. What about antidepressants? It seems everybody's being prescribed these things. Are they effective? And when do the risks really outweigh any benefits?
Antidepressants are very effective. People who really meet criteria, who are depressed, who have feelings of worthlessness. There are actually two forms of depression. I might describe these first, and they both respond to antidepressants. The first is called melancholic depression, and it kind of contradicts the term depression insofar it is often associated with anxiety, especially directed about the self, increased vigilance, fear, and dread of the future. It's associated often with increased heart rate and blood pressure, with inflammation and increased blood clotting. And this form of depression, melancholia, is associated with feelings that are worse in the morning than in the evening, that get a little bit better as the day progresses, and with a lot of agitation, activation, and increased motor activity. People with melancholic depression lose weight, they lose their appetite, and they lose weight, and they have insomnia, especially early morning awakening. They wake up at 2 or 3 in the morning involuntarily and may or may not be able to get back to sleep. There's another form of depression called atypical depression, and it is almost the opposite of melancholia. It's associated with increased appetite, increased fatigue, a sort of a feeling of emptiness, a sense of loneliness, a sense of detachment from self, from your own history, and from the people that you love and from your friends. And as I mentioned, with a certain kind of emptiness. And this is a pathological suppression of thought and feeling. And I conceptualize the melancholia subtype as an activation of the stress system and the atypical depression as a pathologic inactivation of the stress system. And so those are the two major forms of depression. And they may tend to respond to different antidepressive agents. Antidepressants are very effective, although we still have more work to do in making them yet more effective and to act faster. But the current antidepressants have a response rate of about 65 to 70%, which is a pretty good hit rate. If the person doesn't respond to the first antidepressant, adding a second one or trying other ones will increase the response rate above that. It takes 2 to 3 weeks for antidepressants to work, and so that's frustrating for patients because they don't feel better right away and they assume that the antidepressant is failing them. But they have to be told very clearly not to expect responses for 2 to 3 weeks. The newer antidepressants, like the serotonin uptake blockers, like Prozac, have very few side effects. They don't have cardiac side effects. They don't affect inflammation or clotting. As a matter of fact, when they work and the depressive features go away, and I forgot to add an incapacity to experience pleasure as part of both forms of depression, that when they work, they also clear up the biological, physiological changes that affect the heart, metabolism, and bone growth. So they not only promote recovery from the agony of the depression, but they neutralize the biological effects that shorten the person's existence. Earlier forms of depression, like tricyclic antidepressants, like Elavil, for instance, did have some cardiac effects and have to be given cautiously to elderly people or to people with cardiac disease. Now that we know that depression represents a stress response that has run awry, we are focusing targets in the stress system for new antidepressants. And currently, 25 new compounds are being tested to treat depressive illness. These compounds either tone down the stress system or tone it up, depending on what the need is. There are already a couple of new generation antidepressants that work quickly, almost within 12 hours, that produce very powerful release responses to depression and the biological consequences of the depression, and that produce prolonged remissions. One of these that most people have probably heard of is ketamine. Ketamine is used as an anesthetic and it's a drug of abuse, but in microdoses, it was discovered that it resolves depression. And people can get ketamine now to treat depressions that don't respond to the common agents. There are also agents that correct cellular abnormalities in depression that have been discovered recently that impair the function of neurons and their capacity to bear stress and to survive stress. Many of these are well along testing, and they'll be available, I'll bet, within a year or two, and will change the ballpark in our treatment of depression. Another major area of development, very surprisingly, has been the use of psychedelic agents like psilocybin or MDMA in very small microdoses. And they have rapid antidepressant effects. They're very effective. There was an article in the New England Journal of Medicine that showed that psychedelic drugs were more effective more frequently and faster than the standard antidepressants. These are in accelerated testing. The FDA has given them fast track status, so they may be available in a year or two. And I think they'll have a profound effect on the treatment of depression.
Right. Let me ask you this. I had a patient that was on antidepressants for 15 years, and she's still on them. And she had a very traumatic experience, lost her husband, lost her business, a lot of stress, got really depressed. But life's good now. She's feeling good. And I said, why are you still taking them? She says, because my doctor keeps renewing them. Is there a time where maybe, hey, life's better, get off these things? It's not a life sentence, but so many MDs want to just keep you on things forever.
Well, I tell you, you know, depression is a lifetime illness for many people. It's a recurrent illness that comes in episodes. So there's an episode of depression and recovery, but then there's another episode of depression and recovery. And people who are untreated will have several episodes, some lasting for months at a time. And there have been studies that show that if you stop the antidepressant after a year, the relapse rate is 5 times greater than if you sustain the administration of the antidepressants. And some people, like myself, feel if it was a really severe depression that it lasted a long time and that responded to treatment, that such individuals should remain on antidepressants indefinitely. And I don't think that's reckless. The antidepressants are not dangerous. Newer ones are not. Most of the older ones are not. They're actually protective of the brain. They promote the capacity of neurons to bear injury and to survive various stressors and insults. And they probably diminish the propensity for dementia. I do have people who have had severe depressions, who have had recurrent depressions, stay on the antidepressants for a long period of time.
What about turning off the doom and gloom news? Wouldn't that help with some people's stress and depression? I mean, hearing the world is in ruins and we're falling off a cliff can't be good for the mind.
No, I think that is a major stress for people societally and individually. I think that if one is hypersensitive to stressors, and if they are stressed by these phenomena and perhaps by others, they're more likely to become depressed. I think if there were peace in the world, most people are able to work and earn a living and get enough food, I think there would be considerably less depression. There's more depression in people who are impoverished and poor, and in developing nations where people are poor or malnourished. These are major factors. So what's going on in the world, in one society, really does impact the tendency and susceptibility to depression. I think you're right.
Yeah, especially because we don't have a good news network. We can just watch the good news. When the news is now, if it bleeds, it leads. So it's always got to be negative. I want to hear about that cat that got rescued from the tree and see the mom crying as she's holding the cat. We just don't see those kind of touching stories.
No, we don't see these things. There are thousands of them going on around us all the time, but they don't sell newspapers. And I think that if the tenor of the news changed and there were many heartwarming stories, people would feel better.
So true, so true. Such great information. I'm sure many of the listeners took some great notes. In the minute or two we have left, anything else that you'd like to share that we didn't cover today?
One thing I would say is that people who are prone to depression are not deficient in any way. They're not less capable of dealing with the ups and downs of life. They're not less courageous. They're not less adaptable. There's a biological predisposition. I respect people who are able to endure depressions and keep going because they can be so painful. There is a 15% suicide rate in untreated depression in studies that were done quite a while ago. And people who are able to endure the depression, I think, deserve a lot of credit
for their courage and their capacity for that kind of endurance. And I think when people get over depression, they have learned traits that have helped them cope with the depression that make them stronger and more resilient and less susceptible to depression. I'm very upset by the stigma that society attaches to depression. I have great respect for people who endure depression and recover and go on to lead lives that are gratifying to them.
Well said. I want to thank you so much for joining us today and shedding some needed light and bringing hope to those dealing with a serious health condition. Dr. Gold's book is called Breaking Through Depression, A Guide to the Next Generation of Promising Research and Revolutionary New Treatments. You can get your copy on Amazon and barnesandnoble.com. And this book gives you a thorough, up-to-date, and upbeat overview of all the current scientific research about mood disorders and their treatment. If you heard Dr. Gold share something today that somebody you know needs to hear, send them a link to this podcast. It's available at toyourgoodhealthradio.com and radiomd.com. And peruse our podcast library and share segments of interest with friends, family, coworkers, and on social media. This information is too important. Don't keep it to yourself. Sharing is caring, as I always say. You can also subscribe to our podcast on Apple, Spotify, and iHeartRadio. Be sure and follow me on Facebook and X at Dr. David Friedman. On Instagram, I'm at Dr. D. Friedman. More to come. Stay tuned and stay well.